Welcome to episode 44 of Booty and Bossy Eat, Drink, Knit. Excellent. So spring has finally sprung in the Pacific Northwest. Yay! The cherry trees are out. The tulips are out. It's quite beautiful here. And we've had some wonderful spring weather. So we are bringing to you a delicious spring risotto. And this one is, once again, it's funny that it's from her cookbook, Back to Basics. So we are going back to Ina Garten and back to basics.
Yes.
And it is called the Spring Green Risotto.
Yes.
So you want to tell us what the recipe is?
Well, I will say that it's probably not the typical Booty and Bossy recipe and that it does take more than one pot. It is a little bit, well, it's a risotto, so you have to do a little bit of stirring. But like Ina says, this is a very therapeutic dinner after a hectic day. I turn up the music, pour myself a nice glass of white wine. Had she known about Debbie's killer sangria, she might have put that in. But she pours herself a nice glass of white wine and stirs away. Probably takes maybe about 45 minutes start to finish, would you say?
Yeah, I think that's right. It is therapeutic. I think she's right. In this case, instead of onions, we have leeks. So yeah. The chopping of the leeks and the sautéing of the leeks and fennel, in this case, gives that wonderful aroma.
Yes. Something good is happening in the kitchen.
Yes.
Okay, well, let's go through with how you make it. So first, chop up a couple of leeks. She says that you should have about 3 cups, white and green parts. A cup of chopped fennel. For me, that was about one bulb, and you're going to saute that for about 5 to 7 minutes in a glug of olive oil and then tablespoon and a half of butter. Then you're going to add 1.5 cups of arborio rice. This is an instance where actually you shouldn't rinse the rice, because if you want it to have that creamy texture, then you actually want to leave that starch on there. So rinsing the rice is great if you want to have definition of individual grains, or if you're making like a rice pudding. But for risottos, don't rinse the rice. You're going to let that get nice and coated with the fennel and the olive oil and the butter and the leeks. And then you're going to add 2/3 of a cup of dry white wine. You could drink a little, add a little.
That is the great thing.
During, you're going to have about 4 to 5 cups of chicken stock. She says to have it simmering. I actually do that.
I did not. And I know she said that homemade chicken stock is so much better. I did not have that. So I used my boxes and I thought, well, they're room temperature. So I just added them.
Yeah. I used box chicken stock too. I think there's a lot in this recipe. So I'm sure it would be better with homemade chicken stock, but there's so much in this recipe by the time you add the veg and the cheese that I think you can get away with the box. So then you're going to commence adding a ladle full at a time and basically letting the rice absorb the chicken stock. That's the part where you're listening to the music and you're stirring. And you just keep adding that. It should take about 25 to 30 minutes. The stock is going to get absorbed. I have to say, though, I don't really stand over it and stir it the whole time. I sort of add a ladle full. I stir it. I do some other stuff.
Well, you had a good shortcut for that.
Yeah, there is another way that you can do this. You add the wine, like we said, coat that, let the rice absorb the wine, and then you just add like 4 cups of chicken stock. You want to make it in a Dutch oven, such as Le Creuset. America. So you can add the chicken stock all at once, turn it on low so it's simmering, kind of stir it around, but then put the lid on it and let it cook for about 16 to 19 minutes. Then take the lid off, stir it again, add another about a half cup of chicken stock, and then you're going to continuously stir it to sort of get that creaminess there. So that's another way that you can do it. And then in this recipe, you add the asparagus, which you've blanched, and she says about a pound of thin asparagus. Chop that up, blanch it. 10 ounces of frozen or fresh peas. I just cook the asparagus for about 4 or 5 minutes in salted water, and then I just poured that hot water in a colander. The peas were already in it, and that just kind of heated it up. So you add the asparagus and the peas and stir that in together, and then you add a half cup of Parmesan cheese. Plus, you want to have a little extra in there and some lemon zest, 2 teaspoons or so, however much you want. A little bit of salt, maybe 2 teaspoons, and a teaspoon of pepper. I find that Ina is a little heavy on the salt, but in this case,
I know a lot of people recommend low sodium chicken stock so that you can monitor and add however much salt you want. I use the regular. I like salt.
yeah, I like salt. I mean, you taste it and see. And the Parmesan is kind of salty. So you stir in the asparagus, the peas, a little salt, pepper, some lemon zest. You sort of continue finishing up adding the stock. So you're bringing in the veg kind of right at the end there. It's already cooked. You don't want it to be cooking a lot longer because you still want that nice bite of the asparagus. And then the last bit is you whisk together about 2 tablespoons of lemon juice with about a third of a cup of mascarpone cheese.
So good. Oh, we are not getting compensated by Trader Joe's, but Trader Joe's has the fresh peas, which are really good. Their asparagus was really good. And the mascarpone cheese, I was talking to my Italian friend, and she said, yeah, it's really good and it's way cheaper than everywhere else. So.
Yeah, they should definitely give us some, but no, we love Trader Joe's. So you add the mix up the mascarpone cheese with a little bit of lemon juice and add that to the risotto, turn off the heat, and then add some more Parmesan cheese, and you can top with chopped chives. Booty, I actually had chives from my garden.
If I could do the trumpet sound, I would. Excellent.
I love chives. If there's one herb I think that everybody should grow, it would be chives because A, they come back every year. Now, last year, some little varmint, some bunnies, some deer, something like ate all of my chives. I went down and it was like they had been mowed. But I don't know. They have now suffered for it. I shouldn't say that. They're probably eating them right now. But anyway, they were there when I went down to check in the garden, and I was very excited to sprinkle some fresh chives. And to me, this is like springtime in a bowl.
Yes, it's
Just.
so good. What did the husband?
Oh, he loves it. I have to say, we just ate it alone. It would be really good if I had roasted a chicken. That would be excellent. Or ham would be good.
Or salmon. I think I had
Salmon.
mine with salmon. That was really
Oh,
good.
that'd be good.
I think that the chicken would be really good. The ungrateful children loved it. So my daughter, who's a vegetarian, I told her what I was making, and I said it has fennel, leeks, asparagus, peas, risotto, and she said it's like a dream come true. Those are all my favorite things.
So good. And you can use vegetable stock. Yeah. And I do have to say, I think the first couple of times I made it, I didn't use fennel, but I decided for our purposes I should follow the recipe. So I did use fennel. It really doesn't give any flavor, but I think it does give a little firmer texture in there.
Yeah, I think one of the things I really liked about it was the texture. The flavors are really good too, and also has that mix of smooth and firmer textures. And also, fennel, I'm not a huge licorice fan, and fennel has kind of a licorice smell taste. But if you chop it up pretty finely, mix it with a little olive oil, salt, and pepper. It's really delicious. It's just a salad. So I wound up with some extra fennel, and that's what my daughter did. And it was really good. So yeah, maybe some lemon juice on there.
Well, and it also, this makes a lot. I mean, we had each a serving just for dinner without anything else. We didn't really make a salad because by then I was listening to music and drinking wine, and that was all we were going to get. That moment of this glass of wine looks like everybody's going to make their own goddamn dinner. But I made it and it was very good. And we probably have two more meals left. And it's actually really good just heated up in the microwave. You might need to add a little bit more stock. And, I usually put more parm and the fresh chives on the top again.
Yeah, it's not going to look as pretty because the asparagus gets sad looking.
Yeah, that's true.
But yeah, but it definitely tastes really good as a leftover, and it yeah made a lot. I mean, we had plenty for at least like I have teenage young adults in the house, so they eat a lot. But yes,
So
winner risotto dinner.
dinner, yes, and definitely I think it's worth standing over the stove. I love the image of Ina drinking wine, listening to music. To me, that's a perfect relaxing, and it's special. It's more than just sort of your average throw it in the pan. And I think for occasionally, I think it's worth doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the other thing besides the pots is that there are some ingredients in here that I don't normally have on hand, like fennel and asparagus and the mascarpone, but you can get it all at Trader Joe's.
That is
So.
true. Yeah, that's true. You do have to kind of plan it, and it is more than one pot, but I think for the occasional thing, it's worth it,
Yes.
especially
Yes.
for a spring dress. Well, Booty, I thought we could continue our discussion of Anne McDonald's No Idle Hands, A Social History of American Knitting. You remember that we talked last time about colonial and Revolutionary War, all of the women making shirts for the soldiers and basically clothing the naked, starving men at Valley Forge.
Right. Yeah.
So, Booty, now we're talking about Chapter 3, Knitting in the Circle of Domesticity. So this is after the Revolutionary War, kind of beginning of the 19th century. And then chapter 4 is Westward Knit, which is about knitting on the prairie and the pioneers going west. What I thought was interesting, she opens chapter 3 with talking about this period of the emergence of what another historian, Barbara Welter, has called the cult of true womanhood.
Yes.
And that has four pillars. Do you remember what the pillars are?
Piety, purity, and submissiveness. Domesticity was the pivotal fourth pillar of her cult of true womanhood. And within that framework, I'm quoting for the book, by the way, industry was the yardstick by which women's value was measured.
Yes. What was interesting to me was how they linked the domesticity and the needlework skills with charitable acts. They're sort of supposed to be the moral center of society. And with social reform, they formed the Women's Seamen's Friends Society, where they would make seamen comfort bags with mufflers and mittens in exchange for them taking an oath that they would stop swearing and stop drinking.
Yeah, there was part of the book where they talked about this, the sailors would make like spindles, was it? For the women who were knitting them sweaters and things. It's interesting because I think at this time, especially when the women were driving out to the prairie, so they're in these covered wagons, there were times where they were sitting in the wagon, I guess, and they didn't have much to do, so they could knit away, and they would also knit when they stopped. So it was kind of a continuation of whenever you have a free moment, you knit.
Yeah. And the idea of no idle hands keeps coming up. Should never just be talking or driving out through the prairie. You should be knitting too. Don't just sit there enjoying
Right.
the drive, you know.
Enjoying, and I'm picturing like they talked about how rough it was, and of course these women were constantly in labor and having little children, so they're bouncing all around, and there was one poor woman who just had a baby, and had like a toddler, and how the men were out there trying to make the wagon be smoother somehow, which I'm thinking probably failing miserably.
Oh, I remember going out to South Dakota with Aunt Betty, and you could still see the ghost of some of the wagon trails. They're just like these huge ruts where they had worn away. Just trying to imagine people, and there was nothing around there. Trying to imagine these people traversing this great expanse of nothingness and how they even decided, let's stop and live here when there was nothing.
Right, just filth and dust and ugh. The quote is, "Laws of honey, I can't believe you were on the plains." Because they were just covered in dust and grime and constantly.
Well, and I thought that was very interesting too, because this is also sort of the beginning of the era of the bloomers. Because as much as women were supposed to be refined and ladylike, long dresses and skirts made absolutely no sense on the prairie. I mean, they were good in the sense of if you were peeing and pooping on the prairie, they were a sort of instant privacy shield
Yeah,
kind of
attention.
sort of a little tent which you could,
You're
but otherwise, you know, and they even had an account of how these women would walk down the streets in St. Louis and just a veritable dust bowl behind them because their skirts were just sort of sweeping up all of this dust. So you do get the emergence of the bloomers and the sort of shorter skirts. And by shorter skirts, they basically just meant they went above your ankle or mid calf, maybe.
Right. But certainly they weren't using any extra material for things like collars and frills and that kind of thing. It was a very simple look. And there was one woman who talked about how she saw someone new in town who was dressed very cleanly, and she felt like her dress was totally in tatters. Her sleeves were rags and
Well, and do you remember Dad used to say all the time, brown as a berry from riding the prairie?
that's right. Well, he would say that about you. Rest of us burnt like little piglets. But
I mean, they had those big prairie bonnets in part because, and they would put twigs in them to kind of keep them stiff so that they could cover their faces. And it was not only from the sun, but also just from dirt and everything. I mean, and it's not like they were washing stuff that often, you know, that would take too long.
right, it probably took water that they didn't have to spare. Yeah, but they were concerned about how they looked. That was kind of interesting too. Like they wore the bonnets because they didn't want to get burnt. They knew that that was going to wrinkle their skin and
And she doesn't say this, but there was also a sense of a class thing there, that if you had darker skin that was tanned from the sun, then you were a laborer and you worked outside. So there was definitely a social idea of keeping the fair complexion that was important to sort of demonstrate that you were not working. I felt like it was a period of just incredible mixed messages for women. On the one hand, they were supposed to be the delicate, frail sex in need of protection. On the other hand, the demands on them, especially if they were part of the pioneers, meant they needed strength. And so you do get this kind of emerging era of women's manuals with an emphasis on health, like walking 2 miles a day. I guess that's like the 19th century equivalent of our 10,000 steps. And as MacDonald says, quote, scant preparation for the trek many would undertake. But
Oh, well, and there was that woman who would race you.
that was the beginning of chapter four. Aunt Becky Morris, who went to a 1918 reunion of the Oregon Pioneers, and her badge was emblazoned with 1848 to mark the year she took the Overland Trail to the West. And she basically says, I'll race anybody in the crowd who's under 50 if the race is at least 4 miles, which is my distance. If you find anybody who wishes to take on such a race, just tell them to ask for Aunt Becky Morris.
I'll race
I'll race you. And I was like, doing the
you.
math here, Booty, this is 1918, and she went across the trail in 1848, so that's 52, and then 18. So she's 70. So I don't know how old she was in 1848. She's got to be at least 80.
Right.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
And she actually, we should read the beginning of it. She says, we didn't come in automobiles, I can tell you. We came by ox teams. It was a hard, hard trip. Hard work, slow progress, and not always dainties to eat. There were no dainties. But we got here. We never gave up, never looked back, just kept on the move. And I guess that trip and the tough times we had after getting here were good for us. Look at me. I'll race anybody in this crowd who's under 50.
And you just had to admire the fact that they were making do with so little. And of course, they had their needles were priority. There
Yes.
was the one woman whose knitting fell out of the wagon.
Well, I think she fell out of the wagon when they were crossing a river. And she was upset that it ruined her knitting because the color ran. Not that she maybe almost drowned.
I fell out of a wagon, which would be traumatizing.
Damn it. Ruined my knitting.
But you're right about the men. She talks about the Mormons a bit. And she says, President Young, so I'm assuming this is
Brigham Young.
Brigham Young, urged Mormon women to know everything about the care of their homes and to keep them neat. Have a place for everything and everything in its place. This is a quote on page 92. If I only had time, I would teach you how to knit stockings, for there are few women nowadays who know how many stitches to set on to knit stockings for their husbands or for themselves. Or what size yarn or needles they require, and when their stockings are finished, they are like some of these knitted by machinery. A leg 6 inches long, while the foot is a foot, or a foot and a half long, or the leg only big enough for a boy 10 years old, while the foot is big enough for any miner in the country. You know this is extravagant, but it is a fact that the art of knitting stockings is not near so generally understood among the ladies as it should be. I could tell you how it should be done had I time and knew how myself.
That is the best. Like, I could tell you if I knew. Tell you if I had time. And oh wait, I don't know.
I just know what I don't like.
I know what I don't like. I know when those damn stockings don't fit. He and George Washington with the socks. It's like, make your own damn socks. Wait, I don't know how to.
Right, but I don't know how, and I'm not going to learn.
But you know who should be learning? Those women.
Right, exactly. Then this is, of course, the polygamists. So, yeah.
Right. Well, the Mormons were apparently known for their excellent knitting and needlework skills. And when they started, and this became sort of a thing in the West too, to have these agricultural fairs where women would present their knitting and get prizes. And apparently the Mormon stockings were quite impressive
Right.
and prize worthy. But part of that was, and again, it kind of goes back to the Revolutionary War of being economically independent. Brigham Young did not want his following in any way relying on any goods coming from the East Coast. He wanted them to be self-sufficient, and all of those domestic skills were aimed at cultivating self-sufficiency. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, that was really interesting. She talks also about the interactions with Native Americans. This book was written,
Was published in 1988.
it was 1988. I think now you'd have more primary sources from Native Americans. She kind of implies that the Native Americans were not knitting, and they were. It's just the, since she's getting all of her sources from the pioneer women and not any from the Native American side of things, so it's kind of like the pioneer women are teaching or knitting
Right.
for the Native Americans, and they were admiring the Native American beadwork. There are tribes that are known for their knitting, and so and yeah, it's a bit one-sided on that aspect of it.
I thought this idea of women, sort of these mixed expectations. On the one hand, they're supposed to be weak, but I thought MacDonald, I liked how she summed it up when she said, they were asked to share the planning, but only within their feminine sphere. They were expected to be fit for physical tasks, but only on an emergency basis. What were they, like first responders?
Right, exactly. Essentially, they are.
And then they were to transfer the felicity and comfort of home to a cramped prairie schooner for weeks and months of tortured anxiety with little control over the trip's execution. When you just think about, they were carrying everything with them, and there weren't any stores. There was no place to stop, and resupply. I just thought it was amazing. And some of the ingeniousness, like, I love the part where this one family, they brought a cow. They milked every morning. And the woman explained, after breakfast, I strain the milk into an old-fashioned churn that is big at the bottom and little at the top, cover it closely, fix it to the front of the freight wagon, where it will be churned by the motion of the wagon, and we will have a pat of the sweetest, most delicious butter when we stop in the evening.
I thought that was amazing. I probably didn't have any bread, but put the butter churn in the front of your wagon.
Can a Tesla do that? I don't think so.
Well, yeah. And I mean, if I were those women, I'd be thinking, how can we do this, recreate this when we settle? And we, because that would be way easier than churning the butter myself.
I also, just to continue from last time, you remember we talked about how children were expected to knit, and children are still expected to knit. And so, in this period of American history, and this one person remembered, if we were neglectful of our work or ran away, I love that idea, because that was my strategy when I was little, was run away. Ran away, there was always a little switch called a persuader hand.
Yeah, a persuader. I know. Oh, yay. And right. And the boys were knitting as well as the girls. At least some of them were taught
Yeah.
how to knit. So.
I love the stories of, well, like I said, this sort of cult of domesticity, and then all of these books and instruction manuals, which seem to have mainly been plagiarized from continental sources and things like that. And the directions stunk. Like things like, use regular needles, don't knit tight or too loosely. But anyway, there was this one book called The Little Girl's Own Book. was in 1834, and inscribed, it said, Miss Amanda Hess's book presented to her by her mother. Does this remind you of any book from our childhood?
We help mommy every day.
That golden book of propaganda?
Yeah. Did I send that to you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I found it on the ABE, the secondhand online bookshop. And yeah, We Help Mommy Every Day. It was like, we help mommy vacuum and bake and do the laundry. Also, Bossy used to clean the whole house for 25 cents.
I don't know how good a job I did, but I remember mom used to get me to clean the whole house. I mean, I remember reading that book and thinking, oh, and I think there was one that was like, we help daddy on the weekends or something.
I think it was We Help Daddy Every Day, but it was things like mowing the lawn and maybe, I don't know, making a fire in the fireplace. I don't
Yeah.
know.
It was so gendered,
Yeah.
and we bought it like hook, line, and sinker. And I remember reading the book to my son, who was like, this is crap. Not doing any of that. I'm not helping mommy when I can get mommy just to do it.
Good times.
Yeah.
But speaking of knitting, what are you working on?
I have re-entered bunny land.
Oh,
I
yeah.
started making some bunnies. Well, I started making one bunny for my friend whose daughter just had a baby, and it's her first grandchild. I have knit two ears.
There you go.
I like to start at the top and work my way down. It's
Yeah.
going to be sort of a brown and white bunny. I love how you can pull out your stash and just kind of pick odds and ends. And I think it's probably going to have, it's for a little girl, so I think it's going to have like a pink dress or sweater or something like that. Yeah, and I think I might put a little pink on the bottoms of the feet. I don't know that I want to do shoes.
Shoes are so cute, though, the little Mary Janes.
I know they are so cute. But that's going to delay it like a week. Yeah, the shoes are going to cost a week.
Yeah, I know. I mean, that's the thing with these little projects. They're so adorable and sweet. They are time consuming. There's a lot
Yeah.
of bits and you're sewing them together. And yeah, I have not started the Professor Fun Guy. I think the mystery knit along part is over, but I can do it whenever. So I'm plugging away on Sleeve Island.
It does look like you're on Sleeve Island. Is that the gold wing that you're
Yeah,
wearing?
I'm starting the first, just started the first sleeve of Goldwing. And then I did finish one sleeve of my Kleina.
Oh,
Oh,
so do you find the variety of Sleeve Island is helping you to get through that? Like you're on one Kleina Sleeve Island and then you switch to a different flavor of Sleeve Island?
yeah, the Goldwing is a worsted weight and it's just knitting in the round, so that's good Zoom knitting and TV knitting. The Kleina is more,
you have to pay
I
attention.
just, yeah, I get, it's not really color work, so it does have variety. I'm knitting the Kleina one flat, so there's that.
Okay.
Yeah, and so I don't feel like terrible about it. I'm also doing a mystery knit along shawl with Debbie's beautiful yarn, so that's been really lovely to work with, and very springy. So the nice thing with Marie Green's mystery knit alongs is she puts out a clue a week and you can usually work on other things. It takes a few days maybe to do the mystery one, and then you can work on other things till the next clue comes out. So they're not totally taking over.
Yeah, you know, I think what you need to do is get on a wagon and have those knitting projects and just work on the Sleeve Island, you know, no idle hands and plenty of time, and just make your way. Instead of east to west, you can go west to east. And once you get here, I'll make you some risotto.
All right, that sounds like a good
Yeah.
plan. Excellent plan. I'll be right over, probably mid fall.
Well, actually, I was thinking though about back to the book for a second with the bunnies for babies. One of my favorite things was the Fragment Society, which it was founded in 1812. I learned that this was a period where there were a lot of embargoes against foreign good imports. So people were having to go back to kind of the revolutionary period of make your own. There was also an economic downturn that lasted about 10 years. So there were a lot of people who were really in pretty dire straits. And this group of women in Boston got together to basically provide clothing and bedding to the most poor women, especially pregnant women and children in need. They celebrated their bicentennial in 2012. There's a little video on YouTube. I looked this up because I was like, why did they call themselves the Fragment Society? They're not a quilting society. That could have made sense. Well, it comes from the story of the five loaves and two fishes that Christ fed 5,000 people with five loaves, two fishes. And at the end, after he had the miracle of feeding everybody, he told his disciples to gather up the fragments, lest nothing be left behind or wasted. So, biblical, miraculous leftovers. They took this, yes, leftovers are officially in the Bible. But they took this idea of the fragments as the charge of their charity, and they still give layettes. In fact, in 2023, they helped more than 1,300 individuals, including more than 650 new mothers who received baby layette gift bags, which always include still a handmade item, like a
Yes.
sweater or a blanket or a hat or booties or something like that, because part of their charter is that the handmade item is how love and care is best expressed. I just love that.
When I just love using up the leftovers. I mean, this is why we hold on to our stash, right? Is you can, somebody needs a bunny. And so you go in and you have lots of options to make something wonderful that's going to get passed down. I mean, all of these things are just heirlooms.
Yeah, and as much as that period was difficult for women, I mean, and they did kind of get these mixed messages. I love the fact that this charity organization focused on clothing the poor, and actually they also taught poor women and children sewing and needlework skills and knitting, so that with the idea that they could provide for themselves in some way. And actually, out west, a lot of the women, when they knit, would trade goods for the socks, the famous socks, and things like that. But I love the idea that over 200 years later, this organization is still in its existence and is still providing this to women. It's kind of sad that there are people in our society that still need these things. But I love that legacy.
Yeah, me
Yeah.
too. That is
But,
wonderful.
well, I think maybe we should end on that high note of our homage to the Fragment Society. And I
Yes.
think it's time to say, whatever you do, don't
Don't
knit
knit
like
like my
my
sister
sister
or the pioneer woman,
or
but
the Pioneer Woman. Well,
maybe.
I could see you on that.
They were
But
probably
do
real
check
people.
out our website.
And if you want to support us, you can subscribe to the newsletter that's on our website. You can give us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. We really appreciate you listening, and thank you so much.
And we don't mean monetary support. It doesn't cost anything to subscribe. Mom. Hi, Mom.
Hi, Mom.
You don't have to pay. Was she really amazed that we're still doing this?
Yeah, she was amazed that we're on episode 44. I thought you'd stop with episode three.
Thanks, Mom, but we're from Pioneer Stock.
Yeah,
Yeah.
keep going. Like the Fragment Society.
Do you want to race? I'll race you. But yes, yeah, so subscribe, give us a review, tell a friend. Those are all great ways to tell us that you support what we're doing. And thank you for listening.